Session number 28934, Len Trevelyan, part 7.
Len, you were telling us about the tactics used with the Baltimore.
Yes, well, the essential use of them was for close support bombing, bombing targets like ammunition dumps, railway marshalling yards, harbours and ports, and things like that, which meant a box of six or two boxes of six approaching, attacking the target, so that you got your pattern bombing close, as I previously mentioned. But in order to achieve this, it meant that you had to perfect flying towards targets and not revealing to the enemy which target you were flying to. So this meant snaking the box of six. The leader would snake you gradually towards the target, and then for the last 20 minutes, the last 20 seconds, I should say, fly straight and level, so that the bomb aimer had a chance to get the calibration on his bomb aiming gear, and then you would, as I've said, we'd bomb on the first bomb that came out of their leading aircraft. But in order to achieve great success at this, it meant that we had to have a lot of practice. We were almost like the RAF, what's they called?
The Red Arrows?
The Red Arrows in formation. We really got in close, and you know, we even tapped wings occasionally with the colleagues on the, you know, we were so cocky that we could get in close. The closer you got, the safer it was. Because if you can imagine taking a box of six aircraft, two VICs, on an Essing route, the wingman, unless they could, the ones on the outside, when you did a sharp turn to port or starboard, they could get stranded and drift away from the formation. And to get back in, they had to increase their speed to such a rate that they had a struggle to get back into formation again. So the tighter you could hold a formation and learn to take turns holding that formation, the better chance you were of success in getting a good bomb pattern afterwards. But, of course, the Americans were also bombing the targets as well, but they were doing high-level bombing of what they thought were concentrations of troops and so on, and it has seen that the targets all dried up during movement during the daytime, almost dried up. And so after we had done, I think, 13, my logbook shows that we did 13 of these daylight close support trips, we were switched to night interdiction missions, because we found that the German supply boats were coming down the Adriatic coast in little convoys with a flak barge amongst them, and offloading at the little tiny little ports down the Adriatic coast behind Monte Cassino, and feeding through convoys at night with supplies. So it was thought that if we could get individual pilots to go along and sort through these routes and see if they could spot them, they could drop bombs on the convoy, hold them up and shoot them up. And this meant very dodgy taking off at night time and re-landing in night time in the Baltimore, and it needed a great deal of skill to land or it taken off or to land at night time on a temporary airfield with gooseneck lights and so on, that had to be diminished as soon as you'd landed. A Baltimore, it was got a blind spot. As you're landing, going into land, you can't see below the nose, so you can't see the runway down at the whether you're going to land on it. And we, most of us, adopted a technique of side slipping from left to right, keeping slip to the right and then the left until the last few minutes. You'd line up on the runway to the runway and land, but When you're sideslipping an aircraft, of course, its rate of descent is much more than a glide in a normal glide, and so it was a very dodgy practice. And whether I did 13 further night interdiction missions, but we were losing so many aircraft, one every other night or something like that, that I think after I'd finished my tour, they stopped doing them. But I think by then Monte Cassino had been, they'd conquered Monte Cassino and managed to take it. But so I have no knowledge of the warfare out there after Monte Cassino fell, but up until then we were having a very dodgy time. In fact, so we were working under such stress that on one occasion I seized up, my rib cage seized up with cramp, that I couldn't release it. The CO doctor, the doctor on the squadron, gave me injections, morphine injections, right into the muscles to release them. They wouldn't release, and I was sent to a hospital at Foggia. They said it's merely nerves, and until the tension got out of my muscles, the cramp wouldn't go away. Very worrying, because I could hardly breathe and hardly move. Anyway, it did go away, and I went back to the squadron, and I think the CO thought, well, I've got some candidates here for casualties if I keep on pushing them. So he sent four of us, four of his senior crew. It was Alistair Campbell, I forget the other two, and our crews. We were sent across to the west coast of Italy, to what we now know as the popular place of Sorrento, for a break, 48-hour break. And when we got there, we found it was the Hotel Cocumella, which had been a rest place for the Luftwaffe pilots when they were on, before they got pushed up. So the proprietor of this little Hotel Cocumella was so thrilled to have Brits there instead of Germans that he welcomed us with open arms and put a good show on for us. And I remember that to this day. He took us down into a cellar, which was a storeroom, and there were tables down there. I expect it was safer down there than up the top. Anyway, he's put the four of us down there and said, look, I'm going to get you some drink. He said, and then we'll have some food. And he got a hammer and chisel, and he chiseled a big hole in a wall of this cellar. And behind this wall was a year's vintage of Asti Spumante wine. And he said to us, he said, help yourself to as much of that as you want. Drink as many bottles as you want, while I go upstairs and get some food for you. And the four of us, when he came down again, it was quite a while afterwards because he had to catch a chicken and kill it and so on. When he came down, there were 12 empty bottles of Spumante, Asti Spumante. And we were all very, very relaxed. And I don't know whether we ate, but I can't remember much. I know we went to bed and we didn't wake up until it was time to go home. But I've always reckoned that Asti Spumante was my lifesaver, because I went from after that 48-hour pass, I went back to the squadron and finished the number of tours that were in, amounted to 13 again, two 13s on 13 squadron. And he called me in at the end of the 13 trips and he said, Trev, you've had enough. He said, I'm going to put your tour expired. He said, if you go on any longer, I shall lose you. So I finished up after the fall of Monte Cassino, and I'm very grateful, was I, because I really had been working. We had been working very tensely, flying the sort of interdiction missions with, you'd fly up a valley and looking for a convoy, and if you found something, you were so keen, you were looking down, you didn't realize the end, you'd reached the end of the valley, which was a blank wall of the mountain valley climbed up. and you virtually had to do a Himmelmann turn to get back again. And the technique that we, Riverton and Chapman and I adopted was, I think it was only one occasion that we managed to do this, but we found a convoy, dropped a bomb at the beginning of it, and then strafed it. With my four wing guns, and then peeled off and did a loop round so that the top gunner rivet in his top garret could shoot them from sideways, and then drop another one at the end of the convoy, so you box them in and you shot them up either from the belly gun, my forward wing guns, or the turret as you swung round. And we had a number of convoys that we met along the coast coming in with their supplies, and I remember one occasion when I got back after this flight, the ground crew said, "How ever did you get seaweed in your scoops, the engine scoops?" And on another occasion, I got back and the tips of my propeller, the last 6 inches of the tips of the propeller were folded back 6 inches at a right angle where I'd hit something, either a convoy or something when I was flying low over the sea. But I can't remember, but it was a case of dodgy flying the whole time. And when the CO said, "You've had enough, Trev," I was very relieved.
All right. Len, what was the tactic for attacking a convoy in the water?
It was you just flew at sea level and came across them because they were very small, little, almost dinghies or fishing boats. There was no major ships. One of them was fitted up with Oerlikons or some gun like that to protect them. But when you came in low along the coast and found a little convoy like that, you just you dropped a bomb amongst them or a depth charge amongst them. A depth charge was as effective as anything because it blew them out of the water. And you know, you'd give them the belly gun. I got the best chance to shoot them up with machine guns because they were on, you were on them before you realized it. And you couldn't, neither the upper gunner or my forward firing guns could get them. So you just dropped a depth charge into them. And then the belly gunner, as you lifted up and peeled off, he would shoot them from the scatter gun underneath. But out of those 13 night interdiction trips, I think most of them were negative. And just two or three, one convoy and one or two little fishing, one or two of the boats. But nevertheless, the experience of one pilot, you passed on to the others and let them know what the principle was, what to expect. But from then on, once Monte Cassino fell, they didn't need to bring, there was no opportunity or need for them to bring supplies down because we'd taken them by then, and the progress up Italy, there was fairly rapid after that.
Len, could you compare the overall performance and usability of the Baltimore with that of the Blenheim?
Yes, certainly. The Blenheim had reached the end of its tether. You know, it really wasn't going to be used. In fact, the last trip that we did on the Blenheim was the last time a Blenheim had ever been was ever used in operation. So I can say that my crew flew the last operational trip on a Blenheim. But no, a Baltimore was so different to that. It was flexible and light and powerful and more maneuverable in the air. It was a sweet aircraft to fly. It was just landing and takeoff that the two powerful engines with their torque made you swing violently if you didn't hold on, you know, if you didn't take control of it. Once you were in the air, of course, it was like a Spitfire to fly. You know, you just felt you felt the controls and it did exactly what you wanted. It was a beautiful aircraft, in my opinion. And we could never have done the interdiction missions in a Blenheim because this meant flying up valleys and leading into the spine of Italy, the little coastal veins that led in from the coast up to the spine, little roads along them. And sometimes they were almost dead end, and when you were flying along them, you had to take a violent turn and a climbing turn to get out of the valley and back again, and barely miss the mountains on either side of the valley. So, yes, and then another advantage, of course, was that being a tight turn, we could turn back quickly onto the convoy that we'd passed over, and by Essing or going along parallel with it, the mid-upper gunner could then shoot down at the convoy. But some of these valleys were very narrow, and unless you were very manoeuvrable, as the Baltimore was, you couldn't have tackled that. So it was, in that respect, it was a very good aircraft for doing that job. Close support. Close support with the army, as it was designed for. And I regretted that I finished my tour when I did, because it was very exhilarating to do that sort of flying when you were flying on your own initiative, sorting out your own targets, and when you survive, you think you're nothing can touch you. But we were losing quite a few pilots, and I don't know what their ends were. You don't when you lose an aircraft out on an operation, you don't know why they were lost, whether they flew into a mountain or hit the sea or were shot down. But anyway, I felt immune from danger, and it, in a way, was sorry when I was told that I'd done enough. And I stood down, was for a few weeks. I didn't know what I was going to do. And
Len, before we go on, you were on 13 Squadron, and I know that the number 13 has had an effect on your life. Tell us a little bit about that.
Oh, yes. Well, I was born on Friday the 13th of November 1914, and right the way through my life, 13 has seemed to predominate. I met my wife on the 13th, the 13th of May 1937. I moved into a little maisonette in Vale Crescent, number 58, which is, of course, 5 and 8 make 13. My own name, Len Trevelyan, has got 13 letters in it. But someone says, well, that's cheating, because Len is short for Leonard. But my full name is Leonard John Frank Trevelyan, which is 26 letters. So you can imagine how thrilled I was when I was invited to join 13 Squadron. And whilst other people might have shied away from it, I was delighted to have it. And can I draw your attention to the fact that my crew, Leonard Rivett, the navigator, has 13 letters in it. Freddie Chapman, my gunner, has 13 letters in it. And then when we had an extra member on the Baltimores, Don Bevington joined, that's 13 letters in it. My first tour, 52 trips on Blenheims in convoys and submarines, 52 trips, 4 times 13. And then when I went up into Italy, I did 13 close support pattern bombing raids with the squadron. And when we switched to interdiction, night interdiction, I did 13 trips then, and nothing to do with me, but the CO said, that's enough, you've had it. And I finished off my flying career on those 13 trips. So all the way through, 13 has predominated, and I feel very lucky with it. I'm living at the house now, 157, and again that adds up to 13. And I don't know my age. I've passed the 85 mark. I've passed that 13. I'm going to wait for the next 13 multiple, which is what? 85? 98. Whether I shall make that or not, I don't know. But anyway, it's been a very lucky number. I've never shied away from 13. And I once had a car, 13 TPL. I had an Austin 13 TPL. And my wife said, "That's 13 to please Len." I haven't thought of anything recently that ties up with 13, but I know on one occasion I was the editor or the person who wrote the Arnold News, which was the newsletter about the American trained pilots. He heard about this coincidence and he said, "Would I write an article about it?" And I did, but my daughter saw this article about Lucky 13, and she wrote across it, "Daddy, this is nothing to do with luck, it's all in the hands of God." So that article never got printed. But at any rate, whether it's in the hands of God or whatever it is, I feel very satisfied and happy with 13.
Okay, now Len, you've reached the end of your operational career.
Yes.
And then you were in the sort of suspended animation for a few weeks. And then what happened to you after that?
Well, I was posted to 137MU, which is a maintenance unit on Malta, as test pilot to the unit. And when I got there, I found that I was the only flying type on Malta at that time. I had my own office, my own jeep, and my own program. And they were rebuilding in little Safi airstrip. They were rebuilding Baltimore's and the occasional other aircraft, but mostly Baltimore's that had been wrecked, ground looped, and so on. And they rebuilt them, and then I had to taxi them from Safi Strip right up to Lucca Aerodrome and take off and test fly them from Lucca. And this was a very dodgy practice because it meant that you were driving along a couple of miles along the road like a motor car with this plane, and if a shepherd with goats or anything like that came on it, you had to wait while he cleared off. And by the time you got up to Lucca, the engines were overheating, and so you had to take a chance. There's no way of restarting because there was no way of restarting it up there. So taxed the end of the runway and took off and did all the routine for testing it, the controls and everything else, and engine, the engine power and all the routine things that I had to test, and come back and taxi it back to Safi. And I could take one up when I wanted, as often as I wanted. But I was very worried at that time because I was getting no mail back from home. And, in those days, when your wife doesn't write to you, you wonder if anything's happened or whatever's happening. And the last letter I had from her was rather scrappily written, and I thought something's wrong. So I got in touch with SAFA, Soldier, Sailors and Airmen's Welfare Association, and told them of my worries, and they got back to the UK and sent someone to see Eve. And it was then that they discovered that she had this nervous complaint, which eventually proved to be multiple sclerosis. And and I said, well, I've done two tours overseas, and I don't mind doing another one in due course, but I think this rest period, I should be allowed to go home to the UK. And so although I was leading a non-combatant life flying these aircraft, it was very dicey when you were flying an aircraft that had been through the mill, and you there were things that could be wrong with it you didn't realize, you know. But anyway, I did survive that, and I got a home posting.
Before we leave Malta, Malta was a backwater by now, was it?
Yes, it was. Yes, it was. There was no enemy attacks on it, and none anticipated. It had been a hotbed of while North Africa was operational. It had been, you know, receiving attacks almost every day, but not when I was there. It was,
and this was sort of late summer
44.
And were there any operations?
It wasn't late summer, it was midsummer, you know, midsummer 44.
Were there any operational squadrons still working for?
No, they weren't. No, so I was, you know, the only, at that time, I was the only operational pilot. That we had a few visiting squadrons come through. I remember there was a, we were the, I was housed in the mess at, what was it called? Anyway, it was the ex-naval mess where they used to test naval torpedoes and things in the bay there, and this was a permanent mess at Safi. I remember that a squadron of South Africans came through, and we were in the mess that night, heavily drinking. This was the night before I was due to come home to the UK, because I'd got a posting, they'd arranged me for a return to the UK, and a great deal of, I was celebrating, and so were these South Africans, and then they started playing a game of bok-bok, which is weak horses, you know, one side go hunched against the wall and the other go leap back until they've all got the whole side on the top of the back of the ones underneath, and it usually results in broken bones or damage of some sort, and it got very hectic, and when the South Africans heard that this was my last day and I was going back to the UK, a couple of them grabbed me, and with a tin of, they stripped my clothes off, and with a tin of black boot polish, they polished me black from top to bottom. Oh, God, what a... When I eventually got to bed, well, when I eventually, in the early hours, got to go to my bunk, I got one of the engineering officer there to go into the one of the rooms, and with a basin full of kettle boiled water and a nail brush, I was scrubbed from top to bottom to get as much of this black boot polish off as I could. God, what a state I was in. You know, one of the things that they were doing, they were mad. They got a broken chair. They stuck the leg in the fire and wrote their names on, put two or three tables on top of each other and climbed up and wrote their names in charcoal on the ceiling. Apparently this was a thing to do. Oh, it was a reckless night. Eventually, I got to bed with a lot of the black cleaned off, but not very much. And I was taken out to the Luka aerodrome in a gharry the next morning, ready for a flight back to the UK. And I was bundled in, and I think I lay on the floor of this old Dakota, and came back to with my box. I had a special box made to carry my gear in, because I'd lost my kit. It had been rifled in the canal zone somewhere and had stuff pinched when it was being transferred. Anyway, I got back to Lynham and unloaded and went into the mess, and the immigration officer came up to me. He said, "I'm sorry," he said, "but I've got to check your gear. You're coming in from overseas to see what you've got. Have you got any liquor?" Well, I had two or three bottles of whiskey and some gin, and he said, "You know," he said, you can't bring those clean bottles in. He said, "If they were used," he said, "you could bring them in." I said, "Well, there's only one way to use them." And I said, "Get a couple of mugs," and we sat in the canteen of the immigration room at Lynham, and opened these bottles, and I think we had to partly use about three bottles of gin, so you can imagine what state I was in after that. And the CO at Lynham, he said, "I'm going to lay on an Anson or something to take you up to not Hendon, the one north of the one of the London drones, Northolt." He said, "I'll take you to Northolt, and that'll get you as near as home as we can get you." So I'd phoned up Eve and told her I was back in the UK and would be coming home. and she anticipated that I'd be a couple of days before I got to her. Anyway, I got to Northolt, and the CO there heard my story of how I'd just come back from a couple of tours, and the treatment I'd had in water, and he said he ordered a 500 weight truck. He said, "Take Trevelyan home. Take him to his home wherever he lives." So I was brought from Northolt back to my home at Vale Crescent, and when I knocked on the door, and Eve came to the door,